Perpetual Notion Machine listeners. Probably a good time to introduce the topic of today's show, huh?
Yeah.
Ooh.
What is a hot take, Kelly?
A hot take.
As opposed to a cold take.
Yeah, I mean, you would think it's more appropriate for cold takes this time of year, but no, we're warm. We're warming up the sky, baby. It's, we're lighting up the night. A hot take is an opinion held by somebody with relatively little information, I would say.
Yeah.
It's kind of when you, if you're familiar with the phrase, that's the hill I'm going to die on.
Yeah, so I had always taken it to mean unpopular opinion.
It could be popular or unpopular, but I think it's just sort of like a shooting from the hip.
Ah.
Which is kind of unscientific, but...
But we're here doing it for you guys.
Yeah, it'll be fun. So what we've got here is we've got our little box of hot takes that we've all kind of contributed to. So we're just going to draw a random one.
Wow, you've got a lot in there.
Yeah, we do. We got a lot of opinions.
Wow.
We're spicy.
It's a spicy one. All right, so I'll let Ari choose one.
Okay. All right, hope it's a good one. Science should occupy a wing of the government. Scientists should never have given up control of nuclear energy. That's a long one. There's lots of parts to it.
So this is my opinion.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I feel like there was a specific handoff of nuclear energy and the, you know, how this is done, splitting of the atom. This was handed off to the government where the executive branch gained power over nuclear weapons, for example. Mm. I feel like they should have had a representative come along with that. And that there should be, if not a, there should be a scientist involved somewhere in this. There's scientific advisors. For our regular listeners might remember that we had Dr. Jo Handelsman came and talked a little bit about her time in the Obama administration and what that was like. But I just feel like there should be some kind of science, just in equal power, you know, as a balance.
So fun fact, I was actually just presenting on scientists being involved in policies. And 60% of Americans think that agree with you on that. That
only 60%.
Well,
hot take,
because it's not 80.
Right.
It's not the vast majority, just the majority.
Well, nice. Yeah. I mean, I would agree. Yeah. I think that probably we need scientists in lots of areas of government, not just nuclear power, but like the environment and like.
Yeah, I mean, one particularly relevant example right now is the way the U.S. federal government is dealing with the response to coronavirus.
Right.
We have the opinions expressed here are the opinions of the Perpetual Notion Machine, do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, but it probably does. This is wild, man, that Pence is in charge of this.
I don't think it's necessarily controversial in that he is not a scientist in charge of a scientific issue.
Sure, but the fact that this is somebody who is just so adamantly anti-science, this is somebody who has proven time and time again to not understand the science behind something like epidemiology. I mean, it's a complicated thing. One would hope that he's using all of the avenues available to him and that this is not being colored by his own opinions of the way the world works that are not very scientific.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if we had somebody, you know, in office that would be like, no. I think it'd be helpful.
For sure.
I look forward to hearing you grumble just like that in the administration someday.
No. Just tisking. You made a bad choice.
You chose poorly.
All right, Kelly, are we ready for another one?
Yeah, let's do another one. All right. 90% of science communication is a waste of time. Ooh. Science jargon is meaningless.
Yeah, I think that was sort of mine. I think that the way that we talk about science is pretty useless a lot of the time, and that a lot of efforts to communicate science are maybe have the best intentions but are poorly executed.
So when you say science communications, do you mean scientists just generally communicating, not the field of science communications?
I mean both. I think my original take was more about like how papers are written or how news articles about science is written. But yeah, I think also sometimes public outreach can also not work and break down pretty easily.
So I assume you think that we here are in the 10%.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
We're doing a fantastic A-plus job.
We're trying. I mean, I'd also throw it out there that, you know, like the three of us currently speaking, are scientists by training, and it's kind of our responsibility to go out and do our best mm-hmm. to help, you know, to help contribute back. We understand mm-hmm. these things. If you're interested to know how scientists feel about the world, I mean, this is a great medium for that. Radio.
And we do it in a pretty, I would say, a casual way.
Exactly.
Like, we're all friends talking about something like friends would, but we have a little bit of background knowledge, but we're not trying to get bogged down in the jargon or the details of the matter when we talk about things.
Yeah.
Right. Science is live. It's living. It moves.
And to get a little meta about it, there is a fair amount of research that suggests that humans just generally understand things and remember things better when they're presented in a narrative format. Like, we know mm-hmm. we understand things by stories, and scientists really love to just like throw numbers at you and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I hate it. I was telling Kelly, I'm trying to read papers that are written by scientists for scientists, and I'm a scientist yep. who doesn't get it.
Right. Yeah.
And that, exactly. They're written in a way where even if you do know what they're talking about, you don't understand. And kind of your knee-jerk reaction is like, oh, I guess I just don't get this. I'm just not smart enough. Yep. And that is mm-hmm. almost never the case.
Right. And then you see a cartoon from XKCD or something, and you're like, oh, that's how it works. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's so easy.
Why didn't you just say so?
Always search right. Google Images first.
When dealing with any heavy yeah, science
right,
topic.
Exactly.
Catalysis, there's a cartoon
exactly,
for that.
Oh, exactly. Oh, yeah.
Well, are you about ready for another hot take, Callie?
Ooh, Kevin, you want to read this one?
Ooh, I get to read. Got to come over from the board and head back, and what do we have? Political injustice is inextricable from ecology. Whose is that?
That's got to be me.
It's got to be Kelly's. It's a good one.
Yeah. So, again, I mean, just to reinforce the need for scientific understanding, I think this is a great lens to view a lot of the problems going on in the world today. I mean, we live in a very complex system, right? But there are some ways that you can sort of break down a lot of that facade. And one of those ways is by viewing social injustice, political injustice, through kind of the lens of ecology. Mm-hmm. Ecology is the study of systems of living things and the resource management that kind of accompanies that. Things grow beyond the resource limit and then they crash. And that's sort of what's happening to us. So in a grand scheme of things, in a lot of ways, sociology is reflective of ecology, a lot of these principles. And I mean, a more definite example of this is global warming and climate change. The fact that most of the people that are going to be most profoundly affected by climate change are the people who've done less to bring it on and who lack the power to actually do anything about it. So I think that it's really important when we think about political injustice to sort of, again, bring it back to ecological principles and to think, you know, how is the natural world involved in this?
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because when you talk about sort of comparing the political or social landscape versus the ecological studies systems, you know, you talk about something like climate change, which is unfortunately still very in dispute with a lot of people, or at least the severity and urgency of it is. Mm-hmm. And the resources there in terms of habitat destruction and the status of our atmosphere, our climate, are very real in terms of reaching a carrying capacity in an ecological sense.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people talk about, you know, ecology and, you know, social Darwinism in terms of like our human structures, our social structures. And there's this idea floating around that there's like a limited pool of resources for people in terms of money and housing and things that mm-hmm. socially we value, mm-hmm. not talking about carbon in the air, but these human things, economies, and that like hierarchies are natural and all sorts of that. Sometime we'll do an intellectual dark web episode and we'll talk about that.
We've actually got that scheduled. So to our donor who last time contributed after we had the audacity to mention this, we're working on it. We're doing some research. We're going to try and find a good guest to bring in to make it an interesting conversation.
Right. So Jordan Peterson talks about yeah. this a fair amount. And it's interesting because in that regard, there's plenty of wealth to generally, you know, not have this, a lot of these inequalities that we see. So in these human capital, human assets, like that ecological comparison is kind of not applicable. But in the real ecology sense with the atmosphere and the natural resources, it's a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
I find that fun. Not fun and like a good, you know, interesting fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't that something?
Right, that's what I mean.
All right, so let's do a, let's get a, get in a few more hot takes. I got so one right spice. Here. So spicy. We had to use AI to create new antibiotics because we lack the survival instincts to do so ourselves.
Ooh.
Who do you think it was, Kevin?
I think it was you.
It was both of us.
Oh,
this was
trick
a
question.
Collaboration.
That's not fair.
So true. Why is this a hot take?
I mean, it's kind of the truth that the pharmaceutical industry has not valued developing new antibiotics despite increasing antibiotic resistance out there in the field, because they have a short shelf life and will eventually be defunct as bugs find a new way to get around them, and therefore are not as profitable as something you would take for a long period of time.
And it's also, just in a capitalist sort of way, it's not a great product because you can't sell it for a lot of money. It's not a specialty kind of thing that you can sell for a lot of money. And like you say, it has a limited shelf life. So there's not a lot of interest in developing and going through the FDA, you know, regulatory process. Right.
But it would, antibiotics in the long term would save probably more lives than some of these like long-term prescriptions.
Yeah.
Would you say?
Or the intense focus on rare diseases right now. I get why that's a big thing. But like for real, especially with the climate changing, there's a lot of diseases that I think that, you know, in America, we've kind of felt protected from because we're not in the tropics. But that's moving north, you know,
for sure.
So I think it's in everybody's best interest that we continue, I don't know, to develop these technologies. And if it just takes AI to do it for us. I mean, it got a lot of media coverage. So for people that haven't read the news yet this week, there's one of the big stories that's making the rounds is that this machine learning algorithm detected an antibiotic compound that had never before been used. And it turned out it was an antibiotic. Now, I don't know if it's going to die on the table there.
Yeah, will it get investment to produce it and to refine it and all these other things?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting media phenomenon, but, yeah. You know.
Probably. It could be some good PR for a pharmaceutical company that would like to take that on.
Yeah, like, yeah, this is the robot drug. Robots figured this out for us.
Isn't that so cool?
Isn't it? Yeah, please make some antibiotics companies, please.
If they can make profit off of it, they'll take notice.
That's ooh, basically where's the milk? Like, hot take. Spicy.
All right. One more?
One more.
One más.
All right. All right. Dig into the bottom.
All right.
What does it say? Oh, no.
Oh.
We hit bingo. This one says, I don't give a heck about coronavirus.
That's not what it says.
It is what it
that
says.
That is literally what it says.
Okay. Would you like to read it?
No. That's not what you meant.
That is literally what I meant.
Okay.
So we were going to do this show a while ago, and at the very beginning of the coronavirus outbreak, I wrote in this document, I don't give a heck about coronavirus, and I stand by that.
I guess I meant the heck part.
Oh, yeah.
But this is friendly community radio.
Friendly.
Continue, sorry.
Was that the same week that we did the plague show?
Maybe
I should
no.
throw that in there. Okay, that's a different thing entirely, everybody. Totally different.
All right, so I'm
sorry.
So one of the main reasons is that we've got, what are we at, about 80,000 cases worldwide right now, right?
Approximately.
It has spread since then to every continent except South America and Antarctica. That's true. But let me read these numbers for you. 29 million to 41 million illnesses. 13 million to 19 million medical visits, 16,000 to 41,000 flu deaths. These are all flu figures. Think about that. 41,000 flu deaths from October 1st, 2019 to February 15th, 2020, according to the CDC. Now, if people aren't getting flu shots and there are 41,000 people that have died from flu, why are you worried about coronavirus? Like, it's one of these things where it's so in vogue. It's this weird zeitgeist that got caught in people's imaginations. And I get it. It's fun to be afraid of the coronavirus. But, like, there's no reason that the stock market should be tanking. There's no reason that people should be stockpiling things. Like, I understand that there's some complications with trade and that our international relations, you know, are affected by this. But as far as, like, wearing masks and stuff, like, I don't care. Like, you're not going to get it. It's fine.
I mean, I would say that I give a small hoot about coronavirus, but I totally agree with pretty much everything you've said. Like, be a little bit concerned, and like, if this is what it takes for you to wash your hands,
wash your hands, don't touch your mouth or eyes when you're out and about.
Cough into your elbow. Don't cough on your friend. Like,
all things you should do anyway.
Right.
Yeah. It's not the coronavirus that forces you to do these things.
But I'm happy it's reminded people of how to be normal humans in the winter.
Yes. This is Perpetual Notion signing off. Kelly, Ari, Kevin.
Robert.
We'll see you next time.